Hello, and welcome to Royale Without Cheese, our bi-weekly podcast in which we discuss both the classic and the unknown of art and popular cinema from the then and now. We are your hosts, me, Leonardo Miranda, Miguel Aidu.
Hi there.
Hey, and Tomás Ferreira.
Hey, hey, hey.
Hey. Today we talk about the long goodbye, but before any ados, don't forget to subscribe, leave a comment, or simply give us a little like. The Long Goodbye is a 1973 neo-noir satirical thriller directed by Robert Altman and based on the Raymond Chandler's 1953 novel. The screenplay is by Lee Brackett, who co-wrote the screenplay for The Big Sleep in 1946. The film stars Elliot Gould as Philip Marlowe and features Sterling Hayden and an early uncredited appearance by the governor himself, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Called A Study of a Moral Man Cast Adrift in a Selfish Society. It's a well-regarded classic of Altman's. Now, weirdo detective stories aside, did Royale find as much charm in this 70s pulp story? Fellas, come on in. It's okay by me.
It's okay by me.
Okay by me.
I'm so glad you invited me.
I don't want your brownies. They hurt my teeth.
If you want to cook me some Yankee Doodles, though.
Yankee Doodles. I went on the internet to figure out what Yankee Doodles were. I don't know yet. I mean, a meaning popped up, but
noodles?
I was like, no. A meaning popped up, but I was like, how does that figure in what he meant? I don't know. I don't even remember what it was. Anyway, Altman's The Long Goodbye. I saw it the first time. This is my second time. What did you guys think?
Also, my second time. I liked it a lot more now. I don't think I really got it the first time. I thought it was much better now. Much, much better. Especially the opening is incredible. I really love it with the cat, the vibe, like the establishment of the vibe, of the like the tiredness of the character, the any possible metaphor, symbols that you can instill on him by his relationship with his cat. Like, I think it's one of the best openings. Again, we are talking about openings. I think in the past few podcasts, we've been talking a lot about the openings of films. But
yeah, I mean, I have to agree. The opening is just, I mean, you watch it and you go, okay, I'm going to enjoy this film. Just enough for you to know that it's going to be a good film. Because as you said, it just establishes such a great mood. And the fact that he's all tired and scruffy looking with a beard and looking for the Curry brand cat food. So it's just everything.
You don't have any Curry brand cat food, do you?
Yeah, I mean, so many elements. And then the fact that, at least, I mean, in the version that we saw, the ADR of Elliot Gould speaking.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes for such a distant character.
You know what? I actually think it works. You know, I think we're actually saying the same. You know, it works strangely. I love how the ad lib thing is almost plastic, but it is transformed into some kind of diegetic and yet non-diegetic voice work. Like it lives in that middle zone of it's the classic voiceover from the old noirs. But at the same time, it is the character saying very directly things within the story. It lives in that mid-space, almost ghost-like in that sense. It's pretty cool.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I thought. And it really works. It gives a sort of distance, like you're not really sure where he is and what he's thinking. Seems like a blend of Elliot Gould speaking and Elliot Gould thinking.
Yeah, it's kind of like the word, a flow of consciousness, weirdly so. I think
yes,
you're in and out this inner state, this inner monologue and this outer monologue. It's very interesting. I really love the opening. I think the opening is the strongest moment in this film for me. And I think the key interest in the film for me is the character and how Elliot Gould plays Philip Marlowe. I think this Philip Marlowe from the 70s is so different from the Philip Marlowe from Humphrey Bogart. He's not a tough guy. I don't know how Raymond Chandler's original novel of The Long Goodbye is exactly, but as far as the film goes, Altman picks up this character and decides to open the film and to rely the whole engagement of the audience or connection of the audience to the film, to the idea of, well, we have always seen these PI characters, these hard-boiled detectives, seen from first the work world, the business world, where they work, their turf, and then we go to the inner life, perhaps their room, their bedroom, their home life. Now let's switch that around and present him as he is after hours, which is enough. an offbeat thought, and you see him in bed, you know, the cat jumps on him, he's kind of relaxed, he goes with the flow, he's very much, you know, I think the film carries that flower power spirit from the 60s very much, and it's against the system, against the man, you know. And right off the bat, you know, you see that tension between the authoritative forces of the police and the corruption in the police, and perhaps, well, not the government really, just the police really has more of an authority figure in this film, and where Philip Marlowe stands. And so this character, this whole thing about him is that it makes you wonder, because you start with him in this after hours kind of perspective, seeing him at home purposefully going out of his way to get some cat food for his cat, saying hello to these hippie girls who are always in the nude kind of doing yoga in their balcony. But the fact of the matter is, you know, the cat bothers him, he does make an effort to go outside and get food for him, the girls are naked, but he does not have like a pervert kind of male gaze towards them or try to take advantage from them. He's actually sweet, you know, he asks, what do you want from the grocery store? I'll go and get it, you know. If and whenever they ask him anything, you know, they giggle, he's so sweet. So
You're the
it's kind of
nicest
like
neighbor.
he's the
Better be the
nicest
nicest
neighbor,
neighbor.
and
I'm a private
oddly
eye.
enough, he's a PI with a big heart, which is kind of, I think, the difference, which makes you wonder, okay, so if he's like this, not hard boiled at all, and so relaxed, what will his PI skills will be, you know? So I'm always kind of, the film provokes me for the moment when the plot point will happen and he has this call to action to do the mission, whatever it is, which we then find out to figure out the murder of Terry Lennox, his best friend, which then intermingles with this whole slew of other subplots with Roger Wade, the writer, his suicide desire, and then his connection to the whole plot of how did he die, Terry Lennox, you know, kind of the best friend of Philip Marlowe. Yeah, I think the movie really carries on his back Elliot Gould's disposition, his laid back disposition, and where does his skills really lie, and his morality is very strong. He's uncorruptible. He's there to do the job. So there's this contrast between being laid back and relaxed, but also determined, you know, also never stopping, which is a weird mix. You don't expect that in a character like this. He doesn't demand it out loud. He doesn't shout out loud like Humphrey Bogart would do. You goddamn man, you know. He's very subdued, which
I
is
mean,
interesting.
I don't think the
He
Bogart
does have
is also
moments of
like.
shouting.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't remember The Big Sleep that well, even though I watched it recently. But yeah, but I also think Bogart plays it cool, very cool in terms of, I mean, he goes into a library and like immediately is having sex with a girl. Like, I'm not, it's a bookshop that he's investigating. It's like he's also very much a cool guy. And Elliot Gould also is very cool, but he's also, as Altman says, he wanted this Marlowe to be more of a loser. And I think that's how he plays it as well. He's getting pushed along, he's getting beaten up. He also has this very light demeanor that makes him super likable. And as you were saying, he's a very noble person. I think he's the most respectable guy,
What I
person in
mean
the
is, I
film.
think it's very specific what you say about being a loser. I think that's even more specific than the relaxed bit, but also it's just another age. You also feel like he, perhaps, you know, he's more progressive, I guess, because I would more easily, you know, compare, you know, see Bogart slapping a woman to get the truth, a woman to get the truth. Tell me where he is, you know, like Sean Connery would. Then, you know, this Philip Marlowe, you know, on the opposite, he
But I
doesn't
think
care.
you're thinking
I don't know.
of Bogart in general as his
Maybe I
roles
am,
in general. I
and not
don't
this
know
specific Philip Marlowe.
if the Chandler of Hawks, because
Fair enough.
Hawks films were also very much like, even if you wouldn't say it, but sort of progressive in the way they treated women and gave them a lot of power in the narrative and weren't just objects. And I think that's also a strength of The Big Sleep in how it explores that. But I get what you mean. Generally speaking, the private detective of the 40s in the noir, Bogart included, was a lot more shouty, a lot more violent, like towards anyone, including women. And especially the thing with the femme fatale, a lot of times there was like an underlying feeling of a certain misogyny, possibly like, oh, the untrustworthy woman who uses her seductive powers to trick the dumb man or the man who doesn't know what's happening. I get that. But and so here it is very strong to see Elliot Gould and his Marlowe just be very nice and respectable towards anyone to a point where, yeah, he's getting a little bit played, especially by Eileen. But still...
By Eileen, by Terry Lennox.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's the whole appeal of the film. The PI is off guard. And that's what gets him. You know, these skills are not up to the task after hours. And the whole film revolves around that. And yet he can do the job. But the thing is, for me, being the second time of me watching the film, I was hoping to like it best. I didn't like it as much. I think it doesn't get to me. I think it's filmed in this kind of TV filmish way. The camera is always panning right or panning left. It's true. And not panning, but traveling, sliding to the right, sliding to the left.
What is this guy talking about?
I saw it the second time and I didn't really connect. I think I go with The Voyage because with Elliot Gould, like I said, but I don't know. Maybe I watch it at night the second time, like the first time. And the night time is not the best for me.
It's a good time to watch, I feel.
I'm better in mornings, actually. So, maybe
but
my
the camera,
analytical
I think the camera,
skills weren't
the best. The way the camera moves and the way he zooms in and out, it lulls you in and puts you in this perspective of, like, the camera itself feels tired, even though it's moving all the time. It feels like it moves in a tired manner, like going back and forth like a wave, and then you see the waves in the background. I think Altman really uses the feeling of the film to imagine the way he can film it. And again, these constant zooms in and then he zooms out, especially that scene in the with the police when he's inside, where we see it through the glass, the little glass with his black hand in it.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, I think it's
for example,
really...
This was a very generalistic of me to say, like, there are moments in the film, scenes that I find beautifully shot and where zooms are used. But for the most part, in an overall perspective, I just get this feeling of it feels like we've made here a TV film. But and overall, you know, there are films that has a unit, they compel me more, has an atmosphere. You know, I there are more scenes, more than two or three that really compel me in their visuals. And this one was more of a miss, but I won't say that I haven't found scenes that are beautiful. I think there's a beautiful dialogue scene between Roger Wade, played by Sterling, and his wife, with Marlowe on the beach, seen through the mirrors of the house. There is beautiful. That scene in particular in him being questioned in the police station is very interesting, just for its meaning of, you know, you have this underlying sense of he has been brought to the station because of fake charges. And now you have this black cop behind the mirror seeing his lieutenant, who he had just had a little bit of a brawl with. You know, he's a smart ass. Oh no, what does he say? What a cutie pie he is. And then the lieutenant goes, he's a smart ass. No, what?
That's what I mean.
He's a smart ass. That's what I meant. And then the lieutenant goes in there, and then this black cop, strangely enough, Altman's fixes on him, and we stay seeing the whole scene of interrogation of Marlowe being harassed and abused to give some answers he can't give through the perspective of this black cop on the other side, who says, now he's the cutie pie and you are the smart ass, you honky bastard. You know, there's this sense of social injustice, you know, towards the kind of the police authority, that they more than once do these things of the fake charges. And it's evident because you also see, you know, Marlowe briefly crosses the guy he was at the grocery store in just moments ago to get the cat food, and he says, like, I had to get my girlfriend out of a protest. So, you know, there's, you very much feel that flower power spirit still in this film somehow. I think there's kind of a revolt to the man, I guess. But anyway,
I think it's important to quote that scene, because the interrogation scene, because for me it was really evident of the shift in his character. I mean, yeah, in the beginning you see him and the camera kind of tiringly watching him around and doing these things. And as I said, he looks scruffy, he looks depressed almost. But then that scene where it is revealed to him that Terry Lennox died, I mean, I think it really changes how, you know, how he's acting, and he becomes really serious and kind of understands that there are somehow more stakes here. For me, I mean, the fact that the film focuses on this moral guy that is in this city of immoral people, and as we said, everyone seems to be pulling some sort of scam on him. You know, the police didn't tell him about the charges, the wife is fooling him as well, You said that he's being sort of, as a PI, that he's being a bit unaware of the information, of the complete information about the case. But at the same time, I think that that's kind of the point. And especially knowing that Altman wanted to portray this moral man in an amoral society, that it seems like he can't do better because everyone has something else going on that is bringing him down. For me, at least, he's doing his best. I never really saw incompetence or feeling of
No, I
that
don't
he isn't
think.
good. To me, it was kind of that sense exactly, that he's being constantly just, fooled and
I
scammed
think
by
it's more,
everyone.
it's his demeanor, not incompetence, like you say. I think it's
But
more just
even his
demeanor.
demeanor, you kind of sense a shift after the interrogation scene. He becomes much more serious and professional. He shaves his beard, he dresses up. And even with the interrogation of Eileen, he becomes very to the point and very astute. So, I do sense that, but mostly in the beginning, I think the film and his character take a shift and become much more sort of in the job. And you really sense him as a PI for the first time.
Yeah, in the conversation with Eileen, I think that really underlines that feeling for me as well, the way he speaks to her, and then like when he pulls away her hair and like, oh, so, and it shows the bruise, like he certainly has a feels more like the PI that we know, the way he would interrogate, the way he senses some level of dishonesty in her, even if he doesn't fully understand yet, because that comes later. But there's a feeling, and there's that shot of some photograph in the room, and Altman zooms in, and we see Eileen through the reflection again, like suggesting that the double-sided nature of her in this manner that then rhymes with her and Roger Wade speaking, that scene you were talking about where we see Marlowe in the reflection. But I feel like there the suggestion is not that Marlowe is double-sided, it's more that it's more like a funny remark that he isn't. He's a very easy to understand guy in terms of he's an honest, noble man who's trying to do his best, and everyone around him is playing him and trying to trick him and using him to get what they want, even his best friend. And the way that he intercuts in the beginning between Marlowe going to get the food and Terry coming his way, going to his house. It's very suggestive that, yeah, there's something here that's wrong. The way that Terry going there, it feels like it's a coming of something evil, even if
He
you
has
don't
the
know
scar on
yet.
his face.
Yeah. The
Blood, I
hands
think, as
are
well.
bruised. Yeah, the hand, he's
He has
like,
an
ah.
asshole-ish face too.
Yeah, he's a baseball player, the actor, who didn't act much. Yeah,
He has
has
this
that
very rough
face.
face, and you can see, his acting is kind of amateurish, but he
He's
pulls it
like,
off,
ah.
so
And at the end, you kind of sense that asshole attitude as well. I mean,
definitely.
I had the money, I killed my wife, and it's fine. What do you want? I
Well,
mean,
that's what
yeah.
you are, Marl. You're a born loser. And then I'm like,
Born
shoot the
loser.
goddamn guy. Yeah,
I
pow, pow.
mean, yeah, you talk
Yeah.
about the beginning, but the end, I think, is even
Yeah.
better.
Oh, the
I
ending is
can. I love
great.
it. Yeah.
I think Elliot Gould really pulls it off with his acting. Like the moment you figure out the truth, it builds so much inside you that this guy betrayed him, because you have betrayal after betrayal. And it's kind of sad at the same time because he worked so much to kind of retrieve Terry and make justice to Terry, and then Terry's just in Tijuana enjoying his life and you just want to kill him.
He's constantly defending Terry, saying he would never do that. He would never do that. And then he's like proud of it. We did it. We got it done. And it's like really frustrating for him, for Marlowe, to know that even your best
It
friend is
has
like
a
that.
kind of a contrast between, we've been for so long trying to prove that Terry's death is a lie, that he wouldn't kill himself. We want to retrieve, let's say, our friend, as in we all have a connection to the protagonist, and then it's the protagonist who delivers him to death. It's kind of something poetic about it, something very poignant about it, something very sad and but at the same time fair about it. I just wish there was more of a somewhat of a connection between the two throughout the film, so, some way to tap into their relationship. That's kind of what's missing for me. I always feel a void in the film. Like I see these other things playing in the sense of the structure of how I really like the mystery of how the story of Terry, who seems completely aside from this new story of him figuring out Roger Wade's case and what does his wife got to do with anything. And then I think there's this third element of the gang coming in who harasses him because of the money that now Terry fled with. Okay, so Terry now comes into the story. And then later on, so Terry comes into the story of Roger Wade, the field writer, and his wife Eileen. So then all the threads come together, and the way the structure is laid out is very interesting. Okay, but there's some missing element for me that is missing, which is how these two guys relate. What were they to each other, this Terry and Elliot? And I, you know, Philip, and I understand for some people that that might not be a problem. For me, I would like a hint of something so the finale was even more poignant. Because the finale is poignant on the acting just alone itself and on the structure of... And again, I think it's solely the acting, because Philip Marlowe, as played by Elliot Gould, is so convincing in the way that he wants to figure out the truth. And the way the circumstances are set with this very moral man against this deceiving world just makes it very engaging of a final, of an ending, because everything he worked for turns out to be a lie. But and yet, I would like this kind of construction between who were they to each other as friends. That keeps itself as a void. And I wouldn't have needed much, just a hint of something throughout the film.
I do agree that the acting is important in that scene, but as you said, I mean, the fact that he's so consistent, consistently moral as a character, really makes you understand how he had to kill his friend, because he's always pursuing the truth, and it's always sort of his guiding force. Not really about not really relationships or anything else, just getting to the heart of it, and even if that means at the end having to kill his friend, I mean, it just has to be that way, you know, to close the case in a sense, to get justice. I think that that part is more interesting to me and kind of really makes it the point.
I'm not saying that part is uninteresting, because, you know, I do value that part, actually talked about it. It's more like just a hint, a suggestion, I don't know, something that tells me about the relationship. I don't need a whole scene about it, anything.
Part of it, I think it's because the way we first connect with Eileen, through that phone call that she supposedly makes to Marlowe, but then he calls her back and then, you know, starts the case. The whole connection between Terry Lennox and the Wade family is kind of strange, I think. It's not completely clear why she would call him to investigate the case, why we get Marlowe involved in this to begin with. Because at the first, we're not even in the Terry Lennox case, we are in the Wade case.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think the fact that we are kind of...
It's immediately suspicious.
Yeah, the fact that we're kind of missing something. Yeah, I think immediately it sets up a situation where you're not completely going to connect with Terry Lennox, I think. That's not going to be about Terry Lennox and his relationship with Marlowe, I think. But I mean, just to finish the point that I was making, what do you guys make of that thing where she calls him supposedly to start the case? I mean,
you mean the scene at the bar?
I mean, it's in the bar, but then it goes,
then it moves.
Then Marlowe goes to her house and everything starts from there. But I mean, the whole connection with her family is kind of weird, because in a sense it was just a neighbor, and basically it's two cases happening in the same villa, and they both connect to Marlowe. I mean, it seems a bit coincidental, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it is coincidental, but it's one of those coincidences that I kind of accept in these kind of movies somehow. They are built for this stuff to happen. I don't know, I didn't question it.
Yeah, I also feel like maybe I'm not sure what is happening. Even having watched, I'm not sure. Like, I'm sure that she called him to investigate this thing, but that the point was that it helped with the case of Terry, like, because she was in on it with him. So that's what I assume, but I'm not sure what is the plan there. What is her plan, Eileen's plan, by calling Marlowe? What does, like, what purpose does it serve in continuing her collusion with Terry?
Right.
But I'm sure it has something to do with
it. I mean, do you think it serves a purpose for that, let's say, main storyline of Terry? Isn't she, I mean, I guess she's in concern.
She's there in Mexico with him. I mean, she's cheating on him.
Of
she's
course,
in on it with him.
And of course, there's that aspect of cheating the ultimate secret. But first of all, the call wasn't, let's go back to what the call really was about. If it was really about that, it was about retrieving my husband, Roger Wade, who is in this. Doesn't even know where he is.
But
there isn't a genuine concern from her?
But why would she call Marlo, who happens to also know Terry Lennox?
Marlo is the only good PI in town.
Yeah, no. I do think it is just a coincidence, and that it is played as nothing but a coincidence, because he says, because they put his picture in the newspapers because he's arrested. And then he says, oh, it's going to improve my business because I'm on the newspaper. And then she calls. Yeah. I do think it's like... But again, maybe I'm wrong, but I do think it's like bad luck on her side. Like, she doesn't immediately realize that she's calling the guy.
Yeah.
But again, no, it can't be that, because the newspaper mentions his connection, I'm sure, to Terry Lennox, because
him being on the newspaper was why he was in prison, of course.
Yeah, so it must be a plan of her. I'm not sure what it is.
I don't know to what effect. Maybe a mistake of the screenwriting. Yeah.
But it seems kind of blatant. I don't think so. It's a mistake, you know?
Yeah, no. I mean, Lee Brackett, I think she knew what she was doing.
But whatever it was, it wasn't made clear, I think.
Yeah.
Where she envisioned the plan and exactly what she was trying to gain from it.
But I think it's really also
at the end, from the plan, we just get that they're working together. We don't even know the plan itself.
Yeah.
Fully, like, everything that they were doing.
I mean, that's the things with noirs. A lot of times I don't care that much about the plot as long as it has that mood that carries me along. And that it's the same thing sort of with Inherent Vice. It's just, you know, it pulls me in and I'm going. I don't need to understand every single thing as long as there's like a unifying feeling that I'm enjoying. And I do think that contrasts a bit more with the classic noirs that are a bit more about the plot than these neo-noirs. Not all of them, but some of them.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say with like the coincidences. I can accept it because I'm going along with the character. I'm entrapped with the character. Normally, I think the noirs really function very well. Oh my God, a beaver. Oh no, it's our cat.
It's my cat.
It was moving. I think they function really well when they have a character, let's say detective, in this sense of the noir, that is charismatic and you can follow him along. And LL Cool, to that effect, is very, very interesting, particularly in his one-liners, in his demeanor, in his moral.
He's a great actor. Great face.
He's a great actor. Really you know, I always picture him as young. I always am surprised when I see him older with like how he is now, white hair. I'm like, you're like this. I mean, I always have this sense of you with your black hair and... Like, I think of you as an actor of the now. It's like I picture Robert De Niro or Al Pacino. Every time I see them again, like today, it's like, you were like that. My mind is always like in the 70s or whatever. So it's really weird.
It's really good.
Yeah. But talking really, about...
It lights up always. Like any surface is like lighting a match.
I mean, you can quite tell, for example, the match is a very interesting character trait because you see him in his bedroom. His bedroom wall is completely marked by match. There's always lighting everywhere, a match. I'm like, how does he do that? It looks like a fucking cartoon. And the very opening music.
Literally smoking it, the entire film.
Yeah. I'll get you cat food. In the meantime, I'll do a smoke. And
I got a cat.
Yeah, the opening music feels like Looney Tunes, but it isn't Looney Tunes. Like the tune in the opening scene, and it's also at the end. And then he does reference Looney Tunes, like, you're Looney Tunes' husband, he says, out of Roger Wade.
It's all connected.
So, I don't know. I mean, what do you think that music is? I don't think it's Looney Tunes. But the tonality of it really felt
Now I can only think back of the Long Goodbye song. Not
me too.
Anything else for me?
It was
like...
something like this. But it felt like more Tom and Jerry than really.
That's probably a cartoon tune.
It felt like, or Tom and Jerry, which is not as similar, I think. Maybe they are done by the same company. We'll talk about Paul Thomas Anderson, actually. I can see him lifting a lot from Robert Altman just in this film. You mentioned Inherent Vice.
The Big Sleep.
And also, for example, Punch Drunk Love, like the whole suit of Adam Sandler, you know, being that blue and red comes from here. For example, an actor that is in this film, what's his name? Glenn, I don't remember. The one that plays Dr. Verringer, he's also in Magnolia. He's a fan of Robert Altman. He admittedly so he has said, and he has
And I
worked
think
with Robert Altman.
visually you can see a lot of like what Altman does with the camera movement, the way he pushes in and out. I mean, a lot of it I recognize in Paul Thomas
Magnolia,
Anderson,
presume.
Magnolia.
Shortcuts and Magnolia are
I
very
mean, in the
similar.
structure, yeah, exactly. That structure, like the
The
tapestry of
parallel.
characters, it's all connected. It's a very Altman-esque with Nashville and then Shortcuts. I don't know if he did other films in that vein, but like two is already a lot for that type of like such a gigantic film with so
I
many
think
characters.
the movies I saw from him were The Long Goodbye. Well, first off was Shortcuts in film school with
Yeah,
you guys,
me
but
too.
then The Long Goodbye, I saw Nashville, and then I saw The Player. I think The Player was the best one yet. I really love The Player with Tim Robbins. I think it's a fantastic like joke on Hollywood. And Nashville was interesting. It's long, but it's an interesting film with its rewards. Long Goodbye was a little bit iffy. And the second time around, I was hoping to have a reappraisal of the film. I didn't quite. There are things I like in it, but and then Shortcuts really strong as well. I really like the whole stories in it. He's a good director. There are
Yeah,
other ones that I want
I
to
haven't watched
explore.
much, yeah, but yeah,
Like what's that one with
I
Warren
watched
Beatty,
them.
McCabe and Mrs. McNeil, something like that.
Yeah, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, I think, something like
Miller.
that.
And there's like MASH. I don't know if that's from him. Probably
I
not.
watched MASH. I didn't.
Oh yeah, MASH.
I didn't like it that much. Yeah, I haven't watched much from him besides these. He's good. He's good.
Yeah, great. I love his camera direction. Everything's very smooth.
I can't add. I wasn't impressed in this film. Maybe I wasn't in the
Well,
right
why?
position.
Let
I don't know.
let's analyze which
Okay. I
moments.
know. The thing is, for example,
Because I can only think of good
the thing
moments.
is, for me, he has moments that are really interesting. For example, the scene where you have the dialogue between Roger Waite and his wife, and he's reflecting in the mirror. The dubious of the situation, the fact that these two are talking, there seems to be something other playing beneath the seams, and he's unaware. He's this benevolent guy in the bitch, kind of like completely aloof with his morality, while these characters have dubious kind of dispositions and other interests. But and sure, the zoom when it enters, I think it produces beautiful moments. But the thing is, this language of the camera always sliding to the left, sliding to the right in shot reverse shot situations, even for the most mundane things, has shot reverse shot dialogue conversations of doing this and that constantly, or just POV shots looking through a window, going like this or that. I'm just like, there's this pervasive one technique, one note technique always there. And I'm like, why isn't there a change? He seems like he uses always the same kind of camera movement for everything rather. Sometimes there's a change, but
That's not
most
true.
of all, that's what I felt. I mean, mostly.
It's
Do
not.
tell
I
me
mean,
when he does
it's
something.
constant movement. That's true. Like,
And
for
I'm like,
sure.
what is this expressing? I'm not sure because it's so pervasive throughout the film. Its repetition erodes it of meaning for me. I really
I
don't connect
guess.
it. I'm
I
like,
don't think
but
so.
that's me. That's my subjectivity
Yeah.
with the
That's
film.
fair
I it
enough.
didn't. It, I you know I like films that keep themselves challenging with the camera, and refreshing with the camera. That doesn't mean the camera needs to jiggity jiff or be Michael. I'm not saying that, but I didn't understand. He was always going for this one note technique, and it's so much so that to a point I was like, I don't know anymore where you're going with this. Hitchcock is always very intentional with the camera to a methodical point. Fincher, Stanley Kubrick, Tarkovsky, whatever.
But
This
that's
one I
like
was like,
that's a
I don't know.
valuable approach. There's other approaches, you know?
No,
I don't
true.
think
I
you need to
just
be like I for me it expresses that looseness of the character, that looseness of the context of the, you know, everybody just floating along and the character especially he's like a, you know, he's a tired guy, a tired cat, you know,
Fair enough. Like when he
in a
said
world
that
of
the first time,
dogs.
I kind of understand it. I didn't felt the way at the time, but I can understand why you say that. Like now thinking about it, okay, I can see that. That kind of malaise, I would use that word, in
Malaise. Yeah,
him
that's a good one.
is in the camera. I remember that being a word that I noted down while watching the film, and I can see that in the camera. At the time, I really kind of was jolted by it, and you know, it was
If it
kind of
wasn't
unimpressed.
this film, I'd agree with you, but considering the character, I mean, I do like this camera sort of shifting, even if it just shot reverse shot. And I thought the exact same thing when I saw the scene of Sterling Hayden and Elliot Gould on the porch of his house, and the camera was constantly moving between the two. But at the same time, because it's such a weird film with this character that's constantly going around, and everything, as you said, is very loose. So the fact that a camera is moving kind of makes me, agree with
Yeah.
how he did the scene.
I
I don't
think
know, it
so.
has a weird
I can
connection with the
understand that.
ocean, with the tides, with
Yeah, I think
just the.
for me when it clicked this time was when he zooms in on the waves when they're talking to each other, when Wade and Marlowe are talking to each other, and then camera is moving around a little bit, and then it suddenly focuses on the waves in the background and zooms in on it. I thought, oh, okay, I feel like the filmmaking and the way he's using the camera is very much sort of mirroring that movement of the
I
wave, the
didn't
movement
connect with
of
that idea of the waves, but
malaise.
now I understand.
But I don't know. But I also didn't feel, maybe I'm wrong, I didn't feel that much that it was a lot of shot reverse shot necessarily. At
No, when I
least, but
said shot
maybe.
reverse shot, I don't say he uses a lot of shot reverse shot. I said even in mundane situations, he uses the same one
Approach.
note technique, and has the same thing as when he's doing like a POV shot of someone looking through a window and seeing Roger Wade in the medical facility or in other instances. So there comes a point where I'm like, where are you driving at if every other scene looks and feels the same? But then again, I wasn't sensitive enough to kind of grab that moment with the tide, with the waves, that zoom that you mentioned, and see that, oh, he's using this narrative hook, this element of atmosphere in the film, the waves, in connection to the very own demeanor of the character, this malaise, this relaxedness, to kind of be the personality of the camera, the attitude, the visual attitude of the story. Maybe if that had click, and sometimes when you're watching a film, it's just making that click, that paints the whole rest of your perception of the story. When you don't do the click, you stay fixed to another reading that you made of it, which was this. For example, the other day I was talking about Michael Haneke, and I was talking about with you in particular about the film that I watched, The Piano Teacher. And how the whole cinematic expression of the film, particularly during the opening credits, but also at the end, restrains from revealing the climax, let's say. The film connects very much with music and how music gives us, as viewers, as listeners, a sense of pleasure, and it's rising to a moment of poignancy where we have a sense of relief, and the film is about a very sexual relationship as well at its center. So the opening credits do this interplay between people's hands on pianos playing, and so you have the visual aspect of it, looking at it, but then cuts to music stops, the name in the credit, directed by, and then again piano. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And you're constantly being, like I said, it's the cinematic expression of cock-blocked, because the character in the film, the sexual relationship at its center, is very much about control and giving and taking pleasure. So when you do realize that later on in the story, you're like, ah, I see what you did. That in you see, I see what you did in terms of form, and that became an idea that became a pattern visually. Even at the end, because he doesn't quite reveal the ending, he rises to a top, and then it's like he takes you out of the climax. He doesn't allow you to, you become arousal, but nothing happens. So, I mean, so yeah. So that sense of form with the story, I understood, but I made the click. I happened to make a click. I happened to open myself enough to the film that I've made that click. With this film, I didn't. So it's interesting to take here the opportunity to talk about how much a spectator allows himself to be open to the film, that he makes the click, or that he notices a detail like the waves that transforms his whole perspective. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, a lot of times I feel like I don't like I understand some people like certain movies, and I feel like I don't like I should like the film more, but for some reason it just doesn't click. Maybe I'm missing something. That's why a lot of times I end up rewatching films a lot. Even if I don't like the film a lot, I rewatch it. Even if I love the film, I'll rewatch it even more because maybe something new will come up.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like that's very valuable.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. It's what they say, you know, second, third rewatch reveals a lot. You know, it depends on your disposition as well.
It's the long goodbye, folks. If you'd like to reach out and suggest a film for the next episode, you can find us on the podcast official Instagram and Facebook pages. Feel free to subscribe, share this episode, or simply give us a long, long like. That's how our podcast can grow ever more groovy and cool. And if you're on YouTube, you want to see more videos like this, check out this next video right here. Another episode, another thing, beautiful thing. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.